The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And nice to sit here with you all. So this evening, I would like to talk a little bit about overcoming obstacles to meditation. And in meditation, because we're mostly sitting quietly and minding our own business, the main obstacles are those that appear in our own mind, how our mind operates. What I'm going to talk about can also apply to other areas of our life, when it happens to be that the primary obstacles we have in life also have their origins in our own minds. So maybe that happens occasionally. And as a kind of introduction to this topic, I want to mention an interesting distinction that the early Buddhist tradition makes between different factors of the mind, different activities of the mind. There was a period in early Buddhism where they had a heyday in kind of teasing apart all the different ways in which the mind functions, all the different activities, and then categorizing it into different mental factors. And they had those qualities, those mental factors, which are always present in every mind moment, every mind moment of consciousness. There's a number of factors which are always present. And then they have some factors of the mind which are sometimes present. And those that are sometimes present, there's two general, very big categories of those. And the one category are those which are unskillful. And this idea of skillfulness and unskillfulness is a very important categories for early Buddhism, and I like to think of it as being what's helpful and unhelpful. So if we're going to find a path to freedom, to overcome our obstacles, it's helpful to know those mental factors which are helpful and those which are not, skillful and not skillful. So on one hand, there were the unskillful ones, and the obvious thing is to call the other ones, the opposite of those, the skillful ones. But they don't do this in this categorization. Instead of calling them the skillful ones, they call them the beautiful ones. So there's the unskillful states of mind, and there's the beautiful states or qualities or factors of mind. And I kind of like this division. I like the unskillful because, to me, it's very friendly to us, ourselves, that it's not saying that we have bad qualities or evil qualities, or the wrong qualities. It's saying these are unskillful. And so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it doesn't have the same kind of heavy weight to the judgment. And then to talk about the skillful ones as being beautiful, I think is a very generous, a very kind of celebratory thing, way of recognizing that there's beauty in our minds. Is it the beauty that's always there and we just have to discover it? Or is it beauty that's only there because of when we allow the mind to operate in certain ways? Buddhists have been arguing about this for centuries. So I'm not going to answer that question. But one way or the other, there can be beautiful qualities in the mind, factors in the mind. And what we're moving to, what we're doing in Buddhist practice, is we're moving to decrease the amount of unskillful mental qualities, mental factors, mental states that we have, and increasing the skillful ones, the beautiful ones, not just because we want to have a beautiful mind, but because as the mind has more and more beautiful states, healthy states of mind, qualities, factors, activities, it creates the conditions in the mind where it's easier to let go, and we're easier to let go of the obstacles, easier to let go of the clinging, the attachments we have that bring us suffering. So the pragmatic way of this early Buddhist tradition is to move towards the states of mind that create the conditions for our mental health and our mental freedom. And to do that, it helps to overcome the obstacles. These obstacles are all considered part of the unskillful ones. So the beautiful, skillful ones are called beautiful, and in Italian, the word for beautiful can be bella, B-E-L-L-A. And I came up with this as an acronym for how to work with the obstacles in the mind. And sometimes it's helpful to have an acronym. You can remember acronyms, maybe. Oh, yeah, there's Bella. And what was the B? What was the two L's? What are they? But, you know, sometimes you can remember. And you can go through these five different practices or approaches to overcome these obstacles. So I'll go through them in a moment. But one of the things about obstacles, mental obstacles, they're very much in place when we invest ourselves in them, when we believe in them, when we're caught or involved in them. And I've known people who really believe their thoughts, believe the projections of the future, believe their judgments, and they kind of live in them, and it kind of weighs them down or limits them, becomes an obstacle for their lives. But in order to really make them obstacles, we have to kind of be them or live them or be engaged in them or glued to them or somehow. As soon as we start doing like a mindfulness practice or go through these mindful steps that I'm going to talk about, we're actually shifting the focus of the mind from being absorbed in the obstacles, the unskillful activities of the mind, and we're shifting it to something which is skillful or helpful, which is investigation, which is bringing mindfulness to it, bringing a sense of purpose to become free of them. And simply that simple move is a huge sea change. That simple move makes a huge difference, because we're disinvesting ourselves from what we're involved in. We're kind of stepping out and being able to see things hopefully in a different way. So these five steps. So B stands for B-E, just B. E stands for examine. L stands for lesson. The second L stands for let go. And the A stands for appreciate. So this is how it works. So when you have a mental obstacle that arises in your mind, it's fairly common for people to, if they're not kind of completely lost in it and absorbed in it, it's common enough for some people to get upset that it's there and to judge themselves, to feel it's bad, terrible, it's embarrassing, I shouldn't be this way, and have a variety of kind of mental attitudes that are critical of it in a way that's actually debilitating. It's actually kind of stress on the mind, stress on our hearts. So we begin by just letting it be, letting ourselves be. Don't make a big deal out of it. Try not to add a layer of judgments. Try not to add a layer of self-criticism that they're there. Take a few moments, just let it be there in the field of mindfulness, in our attention. And this is where what I said earlier is important, this idea that we are not no longer invested in the obstacle of the minds. We are now beginning to relate to it in a new way. And the new way we're relating to it is just let it be, meaning that you're not so caught in it, you're not so engaged in it, you're not being pushed around by it, you're just letting it be. So what are some of the things you can let be that are obstacles in the mind? There's a famous list in Buddhism called the five hindrances. So there can be strong desire, very strong desire, especially desire for sensual pleasures of all kinds. We know that in society at large, there's a lot of problems with sensual pleasure and alcohol and drugs and sex and many things that people are pursuing. And sensuality, comfort. And it can be an obstacle to living a healthy life. The second mental obstacle that Buddhism emphasizes is that of ill will, having aversion, strong aversion towards things, resentment and anger and hostility and all kinds of, a whole range of things. The third obstacle is a kind of shutting down. That's usually called sloth and torpor, kind of giving up, getting drained, kind of slowing down, falling asleep, not because we're tired, but because we're, you know, just not interested. Don't want to be present, get to go numb. The fourth obstacle is agitation, restlessness, and then they add in this category, regrets. So we're caught up in regrets about all the things we didn't do or what we did do that we feel sorry for and kind of get agitated from it. And there are all kinds of reasons we get agitated in the mind. And the fifth great obstacle that lists in this list is that of doubt. And we can have doubt about all kinds of things. The word that's translated as doubt can be also mean indecision, wavering, kind of inability to make a decision about things, and we're stuck in doubt. So the first thing is to notice that these are happening and let them be. And for some people, that's a huge step because we're so caught in them, so reactive to them, so define ourselves by them, identified with them, that it's just a big deal to have them. And so step back, just let it be. It doesn't mean that you continue acting on the behavior that these are demanding or prompting. We stop the behavior, but we sit there, especially in meditation, we sit there and step back and take a look at it, let it be. That supports the second letter, E, which is examine. Because we can better examine something if we're not being reactive to it. We're not being caught up in our judgments and fears and reactivity to it. When we kind of step back and take kind of a relaxed, more balanced look, then it's easier to kind of study it and see what is this thing really. Get to know it better. And there's many things to get to know about it. First, we can get to, I find one of the most useful things to get to know, maybe oddly enough for some people, how they approach their things, is to get to know what it feels like in the body. The physical, even though it's a mental obstacle, feel it physically in you. Because when stronger an obstacle is, stronger when these mental forces are, they're more likely that it's being expressed in tension in the body. The muscles get engaged in some way. And so study what goes on in the body. In a few minutes, we'll go on to the next letter, you'll see that how this is helpful. You can also study some of the belief systems that are behind having this obstacle. There might be strong desires that are operating, and it might be that you have a belief that if you can just get that thing, then your life will be happy ever after. It's like, or if you feel like, you know, if you can just kind of get this anger off your chest, then justice will be made on the world. And so you have to let the person get their justice, and it's your job to be the avenger or something. There's all kinds of ideas that we have that we operate under that can be unexamined and kind of operate in the back room of the minds, and that in our sane moments, we don't really believe. But because we're not examining them, not stopping to look, we don't even know what some of the background beliefs are that might be there. So we might stop to examine and look at some of the beliefs, some of the thoughts that are in the background that are supporting them. There might be strong attachment to them. It's one thing to have desire or aversion, but you can feel the intensity of energy that goes into being involved in it. And the intensity of our involvement is different than the desire or the aversion itself. And sometimes by recognizing the intensity of it, then we can begin to kind of not fuel it so much or feed it so much. We can step back from it. So as we've let it be there and as we've examined it, then the next letter is to lessen it. And sometimes it's a lot easier to lessen some unhealthy behavior we're doing than it is to stop it outright. And some people who do things which are unhealthy for them, they don't like they're doing, they want to stop, kind of believe in a kind of an off-on, there must be an off-on switch. And they just have to turn it off and stop. And that's the end of the story. And so even if they're successful sometimes for a short time, it's usually just for a short time. Because the act of just stopping sometimes means that there's still a lot of momentum and fuel and beliefs behind there that are unexamined that are going to kind of prompt you to do it again. So the idea is to sometimes to lessen it is easier than to stop it. And so this is where the paying attention to the body is, that the chances are the more strong a mental obstacle is operating, more strong this mind is caught up in something, the more likely it is the body is tense. And one way to lessen the strength of these obstacles is to relax the body, to soften, to relax the shoulders, the belly, to take a deep breath, to breathe deeply. Let the body settle down. It might not go away, but more likely not to be caught in the grip of it. A great thing to do, if you're inclined to do this, is to meditate. And in fact, the stronger your mental obstacles are operating, stronger the power of the hindrances are, stronger the power of desire and anger is, probably the more useful it is to sit down and take a real break. And chances are it's not going to go away just like that because you sit down, but as you sit and be still and quiet, chances are it's going to lessen. Chances are that you're not going to keep spinning around in the thoughts that are fueling it. Chances are your body's going to begin to soften and relax. And as these things relax, there's less charge, less intensity in these mental activities that we're doing. If you're angry with someone, and instead of sitting down quietly in a room by yourself and meditating, you decide to confront the person you're angry with, maybe it'll settle you down. Or maybe it's like adding, a flame to gasoline. It's a risky thing, right? If you're really enraged and you put yourself right in the middle of a situation that enraged you, you might make a big mistake. You might say something that you wish you never said. But sit and meditate and calm down, you might be able to think more clearly. So lessen it. What can you do to lessen it? Go for a walk. Take a shower. Talk to a friend. Some people like to journal, and they get it off their chest and kind of see what they're thinking. That can be helpful. There's a whole slew of things just to lessen it. Make it a little bit simple and easier. At some point it's lessened enough, then you're not in danger of doing things because of these strong mental tendencies that are happening. And so then maybe you can go about and talk to the person you need to talk to, but you're not necessarily going to rush to saying things you would later regret. So the fourth thing is letting go. And letting go is a little bit like stopping it. It's more like an on-off thing. You can let go of some things. But sometimes you can only let go if you've lessened the intensity of it enough. And so sometimes only when it's lessened quite a bit can you finally examine it and see more clearly what's really going on and to realize what it is you need to let go of. Sometimes there can be strong emotional obstacles, strong emotional like desire and anger. But what we need to let go of in the end is some kind of belief we have around it, some belief of the promise that goes with having these emotions and acting on them. So maybe it's a belief system that's going to fall away and we let go of. Maybe it's identification with something. Our attachment sometimes has a lot to do with our sense of self, our definition of ourselves, how we define ourselves. So, I might be I might define myself by the clothes I wear, and today I got my other pants dirty. And so, it's reasonable to come down here and talk to you, teach the Dharma. I should have a little bit nice clothes. So, not have so full of dirt that you could see sitting here. That can be reasonable, I would hope. But it could also be that, maybe I don't go home and change and I come here and sit with my dirty pants. And I'm attached to all of you thinking really well that I'm a great Dharma teacher because I have very good clothes, clean clothes. That would really make my day, and that's really what it's all about. The clothes makes the teacher. And that's what I've identified. And so now I'm really upset with myself and with you and everyone because I've showed up here with dirty pants. So it took me a while to settle down in this kind of imaginary scenario, to quiet down and the mind stop spinning and concern, to see that the whole reason why I'm upset about everything is because I have this identification. I've wanted to find myself by my clothes. And then finally I realize that's silly. And then finally, after a process of letting it be, examining, lessening, and finally then I can let go of this idea that I should really care that much about what you think and what I think about my clothes. I do the best I can, but if I end up having dirty pants, I think that, you know, it's not a reason to get all worked up. So we do this so to let go. Some people are mystified how to let go, and I think it's reasonable if you've never learned to do it. And so sometimes it takes a while to learn how to let go of the kind of clinging or grasping or the holding on the mind has, or the pushing, the pressure that arises in the mind to want something, the compulsions in there that are there. And sometimes it takes identifying, again, the physicality of it, the place in the mind or the head or the brain where there feels like there's a tightening down or a clamping down, and softening and letting, opening up that tension, relaxing. And so to let go. The analogy that's often used in Buddhism for letting go is opening up a clenched fist. So the mind can be clenched around something we're attached to, and letting go of it means to release the clench, open the hand of the mind. And then the final of these five steps, the Bella steps, is to appreciate. And that is to appreciate what it's like, your mind, your heart, appreciate what it's like when you've let go. When the obstacle, the mental, the unskillful states or activities of the mind that you have that are troublesome for you, that may be painful to have been released, are no longer there. And then it's very important to appreciate their absence. Some people will be troubled by something, some mental thing, and for some reason or other, it goes away. Well, then, great. Then they rush ahead into the next thing they're going to do. There's a to-do list, important things to do. That can be very helpful to stop for a while, take some time, and really get a sense, get a feel for what it's like in your mind and your body and your heart not to have these strong obstacles operating. The absence of them are very important to feel, partly because then you get a sense of what it's like to be free of these troublesome states. It becomes a reference point to know what's possible. And the stronger that reference point is, the more easier it is for the mind to move in that direction. The easier it is for the mind to recognize when that absence is there, when we no longer have these problems operating. And also it's easier to recognize when we start getting caught up in the obstacles again, because you have a contrast. So the idea is when you have a really big mental challenge and troubles, and they've really kind of dropped away for a while, take time to appreciate that, to take it in, let it really register really deeply what that's like. Enjoy it. The enjoyment of it strengthens the appreciation, strengthens the valuing of these healthy states of mind. And in Buddhist practice, there is an evaluation where we value the beautiful states of mind. We value the states of mind where the mind is not troubled by things, where it's not caught in its attachments and its angers and aversions and desires and fears and all these doubts. That it's actually preferable to be that way. And it's okay to value these things as long as we don't cling to them, as long as we don't get attached to them, Because as soon as we get attached to them, then we're back in the unskillful states. So we have these skillful states, they become unskillful as soon as we cling to them. So once you open your fist, it's best not to, you know, you like it so much, you grab it. Because if you have an open fist and you like the open fist a lot, and you grab it by clenching your hand, guess what? What happened to the open hand? It's no longer there. So the same thing with the mind. If you have these, if you have beautiful states of mind, and you grab them, they're mine. I'm going to define myself for them. I'm going to, you know, I'm the most beautiful mind on my block. I'm going to let everyone else know, or I'm going to hold on to this and not let it go, or now I believe it's always going to be this way. I remember when I was 21 or 20, I spent a period of time being. The whole summer was kind of ecstatic for me. Ecstatic summer. I was very happy. And at the end of the summer, I said, I'll never be depressed again. That fall, I was the most depressed I've ever been in my life up to that age. The pendulum swung. So this, you know, these, you know, having these beliefs and attachments, this is how it is, tends to make things unskillful again. So, Bella, beautiful. The practice of learning to let things be. And that's not easy for some people. Some people have fix-it minds. Some people have resisting minds. Some people, all kinds of reasons people don't want to let things be. Some people are afraid to let things be because they feel like that's like giving up hope. But that's why meditation can be so helpful, because meditation is often a very safe place to let things be, because during the period of meditation, hopefully you're not going to act on it. You know, you can have tremendous desires to go shopping, you know, but you know, you're sitting still. You're not going to shop. Or you're really angry with your neighbor. You want to punch your neighbor out. But you sit down, meditate. You're committed to not moving. So you get to sit with it. So you don't have to be so afraid of these things. You can kind of allow them to be there. And I find that meditation is, as one of the radical things about meditation is, as one of the friendly or healthy places, maybe the healthiest, to let our mind be what it does without judging it. Because it's safe. Whatever comes up, hopefully you're not going to act on it. So it's kind of safe to let it be. But we don't let it be so we can, you know, let it grow and strengthen. We let it be so we can examine it. So we can step out of its gravitational pull. So let it, so it's an art. Some people, it takes a long time to learn that art of letting things be. Then examine it. Get to know it better. Become more familiar with it. Then, if it's really a troublesome thing, lessen it. And chances are that if you let it be and you examine it, just those things itself will lessen it. But then you can actively lessen it if you can in some ways. Reduce the intensity of it. Relax. And then at some point, when you have enough clarity, you see clearly enough what's going on, you can feel where you're clenching, clutching, holding on, grabbing, where you're pushing, where you're, you know, see if you can let go. And it's to learn to let go is one of the great skills of a lifetime. And to learn how to let go gives us a tremendous amount of freedom. Because we're kind of then in charge. In a way, we're not in charge of our lives if we're acting on compulsions, if we feel driven by our desires and emotions and all this stuff. So to learn to let go. And letting go, for some people, seems like a very depressing form of spiritual practice, because it's about what you're giving up. There we go again, these Buddhists. You know, they're talking about letting go again, you know, like, you know, just like it's a, you know, probably this Buddhist life is probably a downwardly mobile life. You know, it's the last thing we want in Silicon Valley. Sometimes it is, though. But anyway, the idea of letting go is not so exciting for some people. But that's why the last step of appreciation is important. It's actually And this idea of beautiful states of mind is important. Let go well, let go appropriately. What waits for you is not the unskillful states of mind. What waits for you is a greater connection to the beautiful states of mind, the beautiful qualities of mind. Things like compassion and love and generosity and wisdom, equanimity, peace, joy. All these things are some of them are beautiful states of the mind. In fact, in these people, the ancient Buddhists who categorized the skillful and the beautiful states of mind, I don't know exactly what the numbers are anymore, but there are, in their categories of things, there are more beautiful states of mind than unskillful states of mind. Isn't that nice? We have a greater repertoire of skillful, the beautiful things to do than we have unskillful things to do. Now, what which ones you actually tend to use is a whole other story. But it's nice to know that there's this repertoire. So this appreciation part, that's where we can begin appreciating, valuing that there is something really wonderfully gained in the letting go. This whole process that we gain more than we lose, when we learn to soften, lessen, and let go of our mental obstacles, our mental troubles that we have. So Bella, B-E-L-L-A. Be, examine, lessen, let go, and appreciate. Even if you can't do it well, the very fact that you're trying, you're engaging, means you're stepping away from the gravitational force of your mental obstacles, your mental shenanigans. And that makes a big difference. So we have about 10 minutes. And do any of you have any questions about that, or comments or testimonials that you'd like to offer? Anything? If you could use the mic, that would be helpful, please. It's right up here in the middle. Right here in the floor here.
I'm trying to understand a lot. I guess I am a type, as you said, fixed mind.
You're what with the mind?
Fixed mind. So, means, you know, I read books and I always, learn things from meditation, every meditation always brings up sort of clarity to my mind. So meaning my mind gets busy because I'm like, wow, I learned something from it. And because if you don't practice on it, and you're going to lose it. So meaning I caught myself up, a lot of the times just kind of my mind gets busy, like what I should practice, because I have a lot of patterns I have to let it go. That means I have to practice it. So eventually just got overwhelmed. When you said let it go, I sort of understand it, but also I caught up myself like, oh gosh, I'm doing this again, because actually I had a sort of clarity a while ago, but and I lost it, and now I'm just doing the same thing. So I'm just got a little bit confused and overwhelmed. Should I practice it or just let it go? But and let the same pattern happen to me again.
Okay, so I think having a fixed it mind is helpful in and of itself. I mean, we all want to have it. I think in Buddhism, Buddhism is involved in fixing things, fixing our suffering. So desiring to fix things is a nice thing. So that speaks well for you. What some people do is that's all they do. And so they're involved too much in the fixing mind. And so they're not spending any time learning to first relax and letting things be and examining it. So it's possible that with all the things you've learned, you said you're being busy, it's possible to learn too many things, and then you're skimming the surface. You're just doing a little bit of something, never getting good at anything. And it's you might try not fixing for a while, and just letting things be and examining them, getting to know them better before you start applying some practices to them. And then the practices might be more effective. The other thing you might try doing is don't have, for a while, maybe for a couple of months, don't have a lot of techniques you can use. Just have one or two and see if you can become skilled at using one or two techniques. Like in meditation, for example, a very nice basic skill to learn in meditation is to count your breathing. Count your breaths 1 to 10 and do that over and over again and see if you can develop some concentration to stay with the counts without getting distracted. If you count to 3 and you lose count, go back to 1. And if you do that for 2 or 3 months and really develop the muscle of focus, of attention, it's a way of kind of keeping the mind focused and letting other things drop away to the side. If you do that for a few months, that's simple. I did that for a few years. Keep it that simple. And that served me tremendously. I learned so much about myself. I learned how not to be caught by so many things. And it was a lot easier than trying to fix a lot of things. Because, you know, the mind is kind of sophisticated. And so if you're going to try to go into the mind too much and try to figure it out, it's like going into a complicated maze you'll never get out of. But this idea of just staying with the breath and just breathing and just being, I found that a lot of things just dropped away and didn't have to be fixed. So I would encourage you to keep it simple for a while. Great? Thank you. Someone else? Over here, behind.
Hi. When I think about the Buddha's teachings and principles, when I think about their application into one's life to, reduce suffering for yourself and others, it seems like if you choose mostly not to do something or not to say something, your chances of creating any kind of suffering is less. And if you iterate that many times, it seems like if you just became a hermit somewhere and just meditated all the time, your whole life, then your chances of creating any kind of karma or suffering goes down to nil, right?
Yeah, there's some people I wish they would do that.
it doesn't feel right when I think about it that way. So I'm definitely not interpreting something correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everything can be overdone. Uh-huh. I think that it's useful to think about, you kind of evoked Buddhism, I guess, and that's what I talked about earlier, is Buddhism is pragmatic. It's not dogmatic. So the idea that, just do one thing only is kind of a little bit dogmatic. Just go off and become a hermit and not talk ever. The idea is to practice in such a way that your life can be helpful for yourself and helpful for others. And different people, different things are right for them. There's not one right way. There are some people for whom going off and being a hermit maybe is right for them. And it can be quite inspiring to see what some people have gone on to be hermits for a while, how they live, what they've worked through. Who knows where they started? And the challenges that they have to really struggle with, the trauma that they went through, and maybe they really need to step away to really kind of cleanse themselves and work on something. And it was the right thing to do for them. Other people going off and being a hermit is a terrible thing to do. It actually diminishes their life. It kind of narrows them. It's an escape from really facing their life. Some people become a hermit in order to face themselves. Some people become a hermit in order to run away. So it depends on the person. So I think that you have to have some wisdom in what you do. So, if you have a tendency to cause harm for yourself and others by what you say, then there might be a period of time where you practice not saying so much. Until you've gotten wiser about what motivates you to speak, until you've gotten to know yourself better, so you become safe in public. And I don't know how much work you have to do, to but I don't know if you need to go be a hermit for a while to do that, but I don't, most people, they don't have to become a hermit. The strongest, there's two ways of becoming a hermit that I recommend for most people. One is to meditate every day. For most people, that means meditating alone. And the second way of kind of being a hermit is go on a meditation retreat. And the standard length that we have nowadays at our retreat center is for 1 week. And you're not quite a hermit, but because there's 40 other people there, but we're not talking during that time. So the chances of causing harm from your speech is very low. And it's a wonderful way of stepping away from our normal life and really seeing what's going on in a deeper, deeper way. But I think, it's... In Buddhism, the classic way of spiritual life in Buddhism, people who are serious practitioners, is to alternate between periods of practice and being in the world in some way. And so you might go... The old days, Buddhist monastics would spend at least 3 months a year on retreat, and then they'd wander around the countryside meeting people and doing things. And so this idea of alternating back and forth. And so, I think that a good balanced Buddhist practice life is not to be a hermit, actually. So anyway... Did I answer your question well enough? I feel like I'm going on and on now.
No, it did very well, actually. I used the things that I learned through meditation and being here to be more effective in whatever I engage in life.
Great.
But sometimes my mathematical logic takes over and I think about it and it doesn't necessarily lead to correct conclusions. So
that logical mind sometimes is the obstacle.
Yes, thank you.
One more.
Can you hear me? Is that okay? I was just wondering, as we practice to deal with the unskillful mind, does the occurrence actually reduce over time, or is that not necessary?
A little bit slower, please.
The occurrence of the unskillful mind, like say anger, just it arising, does it reduce over time, or is that not necessary as we keep on practicing?
Does it reduce over time?
Yeah, just it arising, just the fact that anger arises, does that reduce over time if you keep practicing or not?
I think that, as generally if people practice, these unskillful states like anger tend to decrease. Their arising tends to decrease. They appear less and less often. If they appear, they tend to appear weaker. But then they don't appear as often. There's all kinds of things that happens that doesn't trigger the anger, that used to trigger the anger. That's the kind of the expectation as people practice. For people for whom maybe it doesn't, there isn't a slowing down of anger or reduction of the arising of anger. They've gotten wiser about it. So it might arise, but they don't pick it up. So different people, different things. But I kind of expect there would be reduction. Okay. But there's so many individual variations of how this practice works. And so I know some people, their tendency to anger has not gone down, but they leave it alone. They don't pick it up. It just arises and it goes. There are times when I've seen in my mind anger arise, and it feels like my mind has Teflon on it. I see the anger arise, and it doesn't stick to anything. And it just keeps going, and it's over. Just like passes through.
Thank you.
So, thank you. And So I hope that in just the right way that you have this week some kind of mental obstacle that will allow you to apply these five steps, Bella. So may it be not too strong, your obstacle, but not too weak either. May it be just the right strength for you to really engage in and follow these steps and see if you can learn from that. Thank you.